It is a great pleasure to welcome the singer for the Rolling Stones, Michael Philip Jagger. Mick,
hey,
how are you?
Very well, thank you. Nice to be here, Pierre.
Nice to see you again. There are so many legendary Stones albums, each with their own very colorful story. Why focus so intensely on the, albeit colorful, story of Exile, but that particular album in itself?
Well, I guess it's got, you know, it's quite often said to be people's, you know, Stones fans' favorite record of the Rolling Stones. You know, people seem to like it. They still like it. They say it still holds up. It's interesting. And so when we were thinking about doing any reissues, and this is the one that the record company said, well, we would like to do this first to see if this, you know, you can do something with reissuing this, because, you know, we think it's the best one. It's the one that people request most and so on. So I said, yeah, you know, that's fine with me. I mean, it has the most songs on it. You know, why is it your best album? The most songs on it. And I didn't, you know, I didn't think that there would be an awful lot left of songs that were unreleased, to be honest, if you know, going to that part of it. But I was kind of a bit skeptical about that, to be honest. But, you know, there was things there.
Well, you said you've been living with this album for 6 months.
Yeah.
What have you discovered as you've, you know, is it difficult to go back to that time and dive into that chapter of your life?
Well, not really, no. It's just, it's pretty documented. A lot of, you know, photographs from that. And I mean, I was working a lot on, there's a documentary film we saw last night called Stones in Exile. And, you know, I've been working on that a lot. You know, that's very time consuming, and as well as looking for these sort of outtakes and extra tracks. So I kind of, you know, once I start on something, you know, I gotta like jump into it. So I had to jump in to see what was going on, and was that really then, and, you know, was your memory playing tricks on you? Because it does, you know. And then what, you know, what are the facts, and when was that recorded, and when was that done, and where what were you, and what else was going on, and what other songs were around at the time? You know, who else was playing music, and, right, you know, and what other great records were out, and so all this kind of thing puts you in the time frame. So, you know, I had quite fun doing that, and, you know, did feel for a moment I was reliving 1970, early 70s a bit much. But, you know, I was quite pleased with the two projects that I was involved with, which was the record and the documentary.
Well, tell us about how this will be re-released, because there are three packages, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about each one, if you could.
If I can remember, if I know. I mean, there's the Exile album as it was originally kind of released, except on CD. You know, it's very just as it was with 18 tracks. Then there's a slightly more deluxe one with the extra tracks, of which I think there are 10.
Right.
Five or six are never really been heard before, and others are alternate takes of songs already on there, like Loving Cup and so on.
Tumble and Dice.
Yeah, Tumble and Dice. And then there's a deluxe, very expensive, but definitely worth it, big book, you know, package with a vinyl and CDs, I think. And there's some film in I can't remember whether there's some extracts from the documentary in some of these packages, but I can't quite remember what.
Cool. Is it true that when you guys went to France, the band, for all intents and purposes, was not only broke but quite in debt?
I think so. I think we were in debt. I mean, we did have some money. I mean, it's like I love it in the films. They're so in debt, but they're living in this incredible house. Like, here's Keith on a speedboat. You know, I bought a speedboat. Like, how do you do that? So I thought they just said they were broke. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we did get advances from Atlantic, you know, to carry us through. And Atlantic advanced on the album. I think that's how we funded it. And but we had a lot of debt to pay back to the tax people in the UK, which is why we had to leave the UK, because we couldn't earn enough to pay the tax.
Something like 93%, wasn't it?
It was very, very high. You know, it was a socialist government, and, you know, the taxes went up to, yeah, over 90%. If you, so if you earn 100, you had to pay, you know, 93, basically. So that was going to make it very difficult to pay back taxes. So we left, and so we're in a lower tax rate, so we could pay them back.
Somerset Maugham, the English playwright and novelist and short story writer, described the French Riviera as, quote, a sunny place for shady people.
That's what he said. he should know. He lived there.
Would you agree?
Yeah. It's just very, you know, I'm going there on Friday. because I'm going to the Cannes Film Festival, and we have our documentary in the director's fortnight showing, which is kind of nice for the director and me, of course. And yeah, no, it's got a work of, yeah, like all these places. It's like, you know, like Los Angeles, you know, on the surface, it's, you know, but then you know, I love reading about all those, you know, those genres of novels, you know, set in the 40s and the corrupt police department. And the, so that's the south of France is not dissimilar to Los Angeles or the West Coast in some of these ways. You know, it's a developed strip of beach, you know, full of rich people and people that were trying to hide.
Some of the songs, I think maybe 7 or 8, actually trace back or have their origins back as far as Let It Bleed, don't they? Some on Sticky Fingers.
Yes.
Sweet Virginia, I think, maybe Shine a Light, Sweet Black Angel. Some of those have some...
Oh, they're all recorded in England.
Starting at Olympic, or was that at your place in the country?
Both, in Olympic and My House in the Country, some of these tracks were recorded. And then... I don't know how many, but you said it's like 7 or 8, or maybe even more. Huh. And then, some of them were played there, and you know, like we were mentioning, Tumbling Dice. That was done in London first, I think. You know, and then it had another name, and that, you know, then it became Tumbling Dice later on in when we did it in France. So that, you know, there were some things that were already more or less done, and that's why I think it became a double album, because we had, you know, one album's worth from France, and we had another album's worth of stuff we'd done in England.
Was called, the original working title was called Tropical Disease, right?
If you say so.
I've read that.
I don't think that's really true. I don't, who cares? But I don't know. I think that was something else. I had a song called Tropical Disease, but I never finished it. But I don't think it was. It may have been, though. Who knows?
It's that memory thing again.
Who knows? I'm not arguing with anybody.
In 1995, you said about living in the south of France at that time, you said it was communal. It was a communal thing where you don't know if you're recording or living or having dinner. You don't know when you're going to play, when you're going to sing. In short, very difficult.
Yeah, we had some experience, because we did a lot of recordings in my house in England. With the same mobile truck,
right?
And we'd recorded, for instance, we recorded "Bitch" in this way. We recorded "Moonlight Mile." So that goes back quite a long way. So we'd done this before, you know. I mean, it was in a lot of ways easier in my house because it was not in a basement and it was a much bigger room. And then when we got to this rented house that Keith rented, there wasn't a very big room, you know, so that you always slightly suffer with sometimes with the drum sound in a small room. You have to find...
Well, there were several rooms.
There were several rooms, which is fine, but there wasn't a big room for the, you know, with a high ceiling. And it's easier to get a drum sound with a nice high ceiling.
I read one thing where the horn players at one try to take laying on their backs. I don't know, again, if that's true or not.
I think they were asleep. That was when they were laying on their backs. They were not laying on their backs playing.
I'd like to talk about one of the newly uncovered songs, which is just great, and it's getting a lot of radio play, Plundered My Soul. Tell us about that.
I think that was recorded in France, and there was no when I found that track in the archive, there was no vocal on it. There was no melody. There was nothing. But the track was more or less as it is. I didn't have to edit it or anything. That was, you know, the arrangement was all very done. Guitar parts all done. Mick Taylor wasn't on it, nor was I. So I wrote the top line and wrote the lyrics and did it. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, Mick Taylor's not on this. And Keith's just playing rhythm guitar. There's no lead guitar at all. So I got Mick Taylor to come and play in the little studio in London and put him on it. And it was just, you know, perfectly solid in 40 years later.
Was he surprised to hear from you?
I think so. I think he was very surprised. It was like playing something on Exile.
It was released on Record Store Day in a 7-inch vinyl, which is very cool, and the B-side was All Down the Line.
Yeah.
Do you collect vinyl at all?
Not really.
I wouldn't think of you as a vinyl guy.
I got some brilliant vinyl records, and I do have a turntable in France, which my children... like to get going as a great novelty. look, it goes round. I'm not really much of an audiophile, and as I travel so much, I just find it easy to just keep things on files, you know. I mean, I do have some CDs and stuff, but I don't really keep them either.
If you get an idea for a riff, Keith used to carry around a little mini recorder. Are you capable of maintaining a riff in your head?
No, absolutely no. I don't believe anyone can. Well, except for one or two, you know, mistaken geniuses. They can remember things, and no, you can't remember. But you don't remember. So I always carry one. You know, I haven't got one in my pocket now, but I've got you. But I always carry a little, you know, one with a little card, you know, and then right. I download it to my computer, and then I can like give them titles and stuff.
Okay. Another new song, new old song, is Following the River, and that is all new vocals, is it not?
A lot of these are. And Plunder of My Soul is all new vocals.
Okay.
Following My River was exactly the same as Plunder of My Soul. It didn't have any vocals or any melody or any indication of a melody. You know, the piano plays a melody, so I sort of went off that. Nicky Hopkins plays the piano, and that was a really hard one to do. I think ballads are more difficult because you're so aware of the, you know, you can't just shout out the odd thing here and there, like in a rock song, get away with it. So, you know, I've got to be really on. But I didn't think that was going to work, but I was really worried I was going to get nothing. But you just keep going, you know, you chip away at it, and then... And eventually an idea will come, and I thought, suddenly I got this top line. I thought, this all works, and now what is it about, you know? But eventually it came, so, you know, I was quite pleased with the result of that, because I thought I was going to get nothing.
We spoke with Don Was, and he mentioned something rather surprising to me. He said that there is a Stones vault where these things are kept, but the actual masters for Exile are no longer in existence. Is that your understanding of it as well?
I didn't know that. Well, you told me that.
Sorry.
So what is in existence then? Because I didn't have them all transferred to files. I mean, I've transferred some of them to all different kinds of platforms, but I thought that we had... I mean, because there was a point in that I did go through all the boxes and put them in all in some kind of order about 8 years ago. Huh. But I thought those boxes were there. Because we knew which ones were recorded where, because the mobile track we had was a 16-track and the stuff, and Olympic only at that time still only had 8 tracks. Mm. So we knew that was Olympic, and that's how we knew, because the truck, everything recorded on the truck was 16.
Wow. Tumble and Dice, it's mentioned in the movie Stones in Exile, and I had read about it before. The lyrics you actually got from speaking to the housekeeper at Nellcott that summer, is that correct?
It was the housekeeper in L.A.,
It was the housekeeper in L.A.?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The housekeeper in France would not have known any English terms.
It all blurs together a bit. But
No. I said, and this, while I'm saying that in the movie, she's in the picture. And you can see her in the picture. And because I didn't really know a lot of these terms. And I said, do you play dice? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, can you just like tell me some of the words you use? And she told me some of the phrases, and I just use them in the song.
That is great. Have you been watching Jimmy Fallon this week, the late show?
I've been watching.
What is your take on some of these wonderful young bands of today coming in and doing Stone songs? For example, Green Day on Monday night opened it with Rip This Joint.
Yeah,
and
I thought really good.
I thought they nailed it.
They really nailed it. And they came over and partied the other night, and after they'd done it, and they told me how they'd done it. They're really hard. We've done it really hard. And I said, great. That's exactly what it needs, you know. Huh. But they was still recognizable. I think they did it really well. And I thought that...
Taj Mahal, did you see him do Shine a Light?
Taj Mahal did do Shine a Light. I was going to say, yeah, Taj Mahal did Shine a Light. And I thought he did a great version. I saw him yesterday too. And he had a really good version of that. And
Keith Urban did
a great version of Tumble and Dice. Very up-tempo. I thought perfect for the song. And really rocking along there. Could play a really nice solo, I thought, on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any chance that, because Friday they're going to show the movie on Jimmy Fallon, any chance the Stones might make a surprise appearance?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
Because you had a little cameo in one of the Jimmy Fallon shows where you...
intro the documentary on Friday.
Okay.
With Jimmy.
There is a little scene in... last night on the Jimmy Fallon show where you have a part in the show Lost, which is very funny.
Yeah, it's very, it was very funny to do. It was really funny to do.
Because, I mean, even Fish is going to be on there. And Fish, for their Halloween show this year, did all of Exile on Main Street.
They did. That, and that's what gave me the idea when we were looking at artists to invite on the Jimmy Fallon show, that I thought that was a good band to invite, because I knew they'd done the whole thing. In fact, I listened to it when we were in LA. We downloaded the whole concert and listened to it.
Were you pleased?
Yeah, I thought it was great. Huh. Really good.
Sweet Virginia has always been one of my favorites from Exile, and I heard originally it was done with everyone in a circle. Is that right?
Which one, Sweet Virginia?
Sweet Virginia.
I think that was done, if my memory... that was done in Olympic. Huh. And I don't think it was ever one of the, I think, but it was done live. I think, you know, the Bobby Keys played the sax solo live. We had, I think we overdubbed some vocals. It was all, it was pretty closely done though, because you can tell by the sound, it's very warm and, you know, yeah, I think that was done Olympic.
From Country Honk to Sweet Virginia, maybe Dear Doctor,
yeah.
Dead Flowers.
Yeah.
There's so many great songs that the Stones have done in a country style. Would you ever, in a set where some bands might go to an acoustic portion, do a little mini country
set?
Yeah, it'd
be a good idea. We did. I think we have done a couple. You know, we did 2-3 country songs in a row. When we were in Texas last. We did that. Bob Wills Is Still the King.
Wow, you know that
one?
Yeah, that's great.
We did that. Yeah, we did that one.
Because you sort of make, you know, do it tongue in cheek, but then I don't think you take yourself seriously, and yet it sounds great. Those songs are fun.
You know, well, I'm not sure you should take it all too seriously. Anyway, but yeah, I do it with a pinch of salt, and I just did an overdub on a Jerry Lee Lewis version of Dead Flowers.
Wow,
he's putting that out, and I just did. I was doing the harmony part, and he's doing as like a reversal of what I normally do. So I did the harmony part. And no, but I like doing that kind of music. And then when I was with Green Day the other night, I said, "Go on, Mick, play the piano." So I play Faraway Eyes. I don't know if you know that one.
I do. My God, I love it.
Solo album. And I was like, "What am I going to play?" I'm playing the piano for one. So I started to play Faraway Eyes. I didn't think they were expecting that one.
On All Down the Line, there's a great story when the band gets to L.A. and Andy Johns, your recording engineer, said to you, "I don't quite hear this as a single. I'd like to hear, you're doing a lot of mixes of it. I'd like to hear it on the radio." And you said, "You want to hear it on the radio?" And he said, "Yeah, but how can that happen?" And you said, do you remember what you did?
Yeah, well, I think we'd done it before and we just took it to the station and parked the car in the parking lot. Say, "Come play this."
You gave it to Stu, Ian Stewart.
Yeah, I think.
And he took it down to some radio station,
yeah.
And you and Keith and Andy hopped in the back of a limo, as the story goes, and you're riding up and down Sunset Boulevard listening to
I just parked the car in the parking lot of the radio station.
Huh. And then apparently...
Best reception.
The story that I heard was that you heard it once, and you called Stu and said, "Have him play it again."
I don't remember anymore. Uh-huh. But yeah, it was a good way of testing. And maybe wouldn't do that too much now, but that was pretty, you know, pretty cool way of hearing music in your car like that.
Well, that's how most people hear it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. Also in L.A., Billy Preston, it said, took you to some evangelical services to help you get a feel for some of the gospel
sounds. I used to go to those anyway. You know, I used to go to Aretha's father's church.
Wow.
Reverend C.L. Franklin. I used to go to his church. I didn't used to go with Billy, though. I never went to a church with Billy.
Okay.
But I used to go to those churches in L.A. and other places, too. And I used to go to those churches in Jamaica and other places in the Caribbean where they're somewhat similar. Not exactly the same. But you know, it was like gospel music. And a bit self-conscious sometimes in the church. But you get used to it, you know. After about 10 minutes, you just lose your inhibitions,
right?
You know,
carry on.
Yeah.
Throw your hands in the air,
you know. Yeah. And, you know, people look at you at the beginning, but
I'd like to talk about the album artwork, because I'm a great,
yeah,
fan of album artwork. And
yeah,
the gentleman, I think his name is Robert Frank,
uh-huh,
that had a book out that you and Charlie found,
yeah,
interesting, called The Americans.
Yes.
And you approached him to do the album artwork, correct?
Yeah. And we thought that his style of photography was very fitted in, you know, to the start of the album. It was very gritty and so on, very American, if you will. So we just called him up, and he, yeah, said that he'd love to do it, and he made it really easy for us because he a lot of this stuff he shot on 16mm. He had a still cameras, but he thought it would be best to capture this stuff, and so we went downtown in LA and did it on 16mm and took the images off the 16mm and made a collage with some of his already existing pictures. And so it was for us, it was super easy to do.
And if you see the movie Stones in Exile, you'll see those shots,
yeah,
as they are on the album and where they originated from,
yeah,
as you're walking down some of this. Is there a main street in L.A. called Main Street?
I seem to remember there is or was, and it was very, very, at that time, until very recently, in fact, it was quite depressed, that section of town, which is what Robert wanted. You know, and you see in the film, you see this kind of how it really was. I think now it's all been rather done up, gentrified, and lots of high-rise buildings. But I think there is a main street, or was.
My favorite shot is a picture, I don't know where it was taken, but a picture of you and Keith singing at one microphone, and you have a bottle of Old Granddad. That's Keith it. Has a can
what
of beer.
What does he have? Bottle of beer, and lightweight.
Yeah, well, no, you had the Granddad. He
that's
had the
that's
beer.
What I'm saying.
Yeah. and it's just a great shot of the two of you singing together.
Yeah, no, we would do the, on the same mic singing, you know. It doesn't always work, but we... There's in the film we were talking about, Stones in Exile, there's a shot of us rehearsing Loving Cup before we took it on the road. And we're doing this on the same mic, and the balance is really good. I mean, sometimes you get a really good balance, you don't have to rely on a recording engineer to get a balance for you.
Even though you don't like to print lyrics, does it ever surprise
you? I love printing lyrics.
You don't.
I do too. I always try. It's other people that say, we haven't got room for the lyrics. It's like, well, I always print the lyrics.
Well,
don't worry.
Or the earlier ones, you didn't.
Yeah.
But does it ever surprise you how many misunderstood Rolling Stone lyrics
but
there are?
And, you know, there's so many. Isn't there so famous lists of famous songs that people...
There are books about it.
Yeah, there's books about it.
There's a book with the title of Excuse Me While I Kissed This Guy.
Yeah, that's it. That's
And that's the title of the book regarding the Hendrix there.
Yeah, exactly.
Fats Domino, though, I think he said the lyrics aren't that important. They are, but knowing them precisely is not that important. And on this record, your voices mix a little lower anyway.
Some of them are low, you know. Some of the more ballady ones is quite high. I mean, when I was remastering it, I noticed that, you know, Shine a Light vocals are very high, and, you know, other ones are really not high enough, in a bit of a mess. The whole lyric thing. But then you kind of, for the lyric writer, some of the lyrics, you know, you kind of like people to understand, you know. But the kind of rock things, you don't really mind too much about.
Right. Well, you mentioned Shine a Light. I just love that song. And, some people described it as your blessing, your prayer, your wish to Keith. I don't know if you would interpret it that way or not.
I think so.
But it's such a beautiful...
Whatever you want.
Well, it can be whatever anyone interprets
it's
it.
It's a very gospel song, isn't it? You know. But I think...
Is there anything you'd say about it?
Well, I remember doing it. I did it in London with Billy Preston. That's what I remember doing. Huh. Playing and starting off playing the piano. I was playing the piano, and Billy was playing the... Billy was playing the organ, and Mick Taylor was playing the bass. I think we had a funny lineup. We were waiting for people to turn up, you know. And in the end, Billy played the piano and overdubbed the organ. But it's really a good. It has a really interesting kind of dynamics to it, you know. It's got so many different dynamics within the song, and we never did this song on stage during the time of the 72 tour and all that. We never did this song. In fact, we didn't do it till the 90s, I don't think. And then it became kind of part of our repertoire.
Is it towards Keith? Is it
no, not really.
Okay.
No, it's not towards Keith.
Because your and Keith's relationship has been endlessly speculated on over the years, sometimes as passive-aggressive, sometimes as this love-hate, sometimes as... But ultimately, you've been together for so long. How would you define the nature of your relationship?
Well, you know, we were very, very old friends from, like, when we were very small children. And we know each other, therefore, we know each other for a long time. Before we started playing music together, we knew each other quite well. So we go back a really long way. And, you know, you over the years, your relationships with people, you know, they change a lot. You know, you get, you know, first of all, you're just friends, and then you can't play together. Then you're inseparable. Then you want to be on your own, and then you get married, and then... You know what I mean? Obviously, you change a lot, but you know, we continue working together for a very, very long time. So, you know, there's always some good things that come out of all that over a long period. We've written a lot of songs together and done a lot of shows, and so, you know, I think we complement each other to a certain extent.
And today, are you tight? Would you say?
Well, I don't see Keith as much as you know, as I see the rest of the band, because he lives in Connecticut,
right.
And I don't live in the United States, and he doesn't come to England as much as he used to. But, you know, I look forward to seeing him when I can, and when we work together, we're together all the time.
Will you tour?
Well, I'd like to. I'd like to tour, and, you know, I'd like to get thinking about doing that real soon.
There is a quality about this band that never ceases to amaze me, and I've been seeing you since Tour of the Americas. the quality that strikes me so profoundly is your ability to even take a 30-year-old song or older and make it sound like it just came off the presses today. It's so fresh, it's so alive, it's so vibrant. There's nothing held back. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I think you got it. You've got to play your tunes, you know, with that, as if you first tour, you playing them, you know. And if you can't, then you should drop that tune, you know, to be honest, because you've got a lot of other tunes, so don't do that, man. If you're fed up with it and you can't hack it, just drop it, you know, and do something else. And, you know, the audience reacts, you know, the audience is like, react to your tunes, and so you just got to, you know, it's a kind of, every time you play them, it's different, you know, because you're in a different place with a different audience, a different night, and you feel in a different way. And of course, it's inevitable with some of these songs, it's hard to make them feel as if they're fresh, you know, if you play them thousands of times or whatever. But, you know, you on the night, you know, you should be able to do that. And if you can't, then drop that tune and do another one.
A couple of quotes that you've had over the
years
on Exile. Well, at one point you said it sounded lousy with no concerted effort. In September of 71, you said the studios at Keith's home are not that great. It's terrible. I don't like it. Later, you said this new album is mad. There's so many different tracks. In 72, you said, I don't know what these reviewers want. We put out a side you can listen to in the morning or fall asleep to at night, and yet the reviewer says it doesn't have a Barrel House rocker on side two. You can't please everyone. Then you said, I think Exile was a hangover from the end of the 60s. Then in the 80s, you said the record lacks a little focus. In the 90s, you said it's a little bit overrated. In 2003, I'm not too sure how great the songs are. But in 2010, you said, well, everybody says it's my favorite. I love it. And I said, well, it's not mine. It was sort of a toss-off remark, and it's come back to haunt me, really.
Well, you know, the thing was that you know, all of those things are true. the thing it was, it's not a particularly focused record, you know. I don't think, you know, but maybe that's kind of a good thing. People don't necessarily want focus, and it's very sprawling, and then so it doesn't have a focused style, and it wasn't recorded, even though, despite all the mythology of it, it wasn't actually recorded all in one time and space. It was recorded over a 3-year period, so that's why you get this kind of disparate feel of it, you know, though to some people it might all feel it was recorded in, you know, a week. It was recorded in 3 or 4 different locations over 3 years. So when you do that, you don't get a time and place record. You know, so if you get a record like Some Girls, which is all recorded in the same studio in a much shorter space of time, it has something that hangs all the sounds of Some Girls are similar, you know, in other words, so sonically it's a very similar sounding record. So you get, to me, you get a time and place record. I'm not saying anyone is better than the other, sure, but it isn't a time and place record. And so that you get very different sounds. So you've got like the 8-track sort of beautiful acoustic room in London with Shine a Light, and, you know, all very well recorded and so on. And then you've got like the kind of messy basement sound of the south of France, and then you've got the add-ons of the LA sessions and so on. So all these things go to make it and a kind of interesting record with a lot of textures in it, and it's got a lot of variety. And because it's a double album, because it has like 18 songs on the original record, there's things on there that perhaps you wouldn't have released on a previous record. Let's say like Just Want to See His Face or something, right, like that. You say, well, oh, that's not really, you don't bother finishing, that's just the kind of thing you just did once. So by putting those, you don't need many of those kind of tracks to texture the album in another way from another kind of record, you know what I'm saying? So, and the other thing about it, because it didn't have any hits. The only hit was Tumbling Dice. The other songs were not really, you know, successful in over time. They and repeated playings by the band on stage, songs like All Down the Line, Sweet Virginia, became famous parts of the Stones. Yeah, they became part of the Stones catalog, but they weren't radio hits, if you know what I'm saying, right, of the time. And so That didn't, part of the record didn't exist. You understand what I'm trying
to
say?
Yes, I do.
So it's a different kind of record from the Sticky Fingers record, which preceded it, which was much more, you know, accessible in a lot of ways.
The state of the health of the band today, because bands are much like family. In fact, you spend more time with them than your family. Will there be a new record? You said you'd like to tour. The cohesion, the vibe in the band these days is what?
It's hard to put a thing on it. We haven't been doing much. I've been writing a lot of songs that were very kind of suitable for the Rolling Stones. And, you know, I've been writing one day I write a ton of blues songs, the next day I write, you know, more funky songs, and then so I've, you know, I'm quite pleased with that, and so I want to be able to go on and record those, and so I hope that we're going to start doing that real soon.
Cool. Mick Jagger, thank you for
speaking
with us.
Nice to talk to you, Pierre.
Cool.
Hi there, this is Mick Jagger. Please join me for an intimate look at the making of Exile on Main Street right here on WMMR.